Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. The 2014 midterm election is on track to break dark money records, and the 2016 presidential election is expected to surpass the $7 billion record set in 2012 because of Citizens United and the recent Supreme Court decision striking down aggregate contribution limits. There seems to be no end in sight when it comes to money in politics. But today's guest, Harvard professor Lawrence Lessig, has been fighting to reform the system for the past 7 years. His latest idea? He wants to create a super PAC to end all super PACs. Over the course of the next two elections, he wants to use the May Day super PAC to win enough seats to pass fundamental reform. And the goal for this election cycle is to raise enough money to change the results in five House districts across the country. In a widely watched video, Lessig says, quote, "Through that work, we'll learn what works and we'll put the rest of Congress on notice so that in 2016, we'll be back," end quote. The May Day Super PAC has managed to raise $1 million in just 13 days, with the average person giving $75. On today's Your Call, we continue our Agenda for a New Economy series by talking about efforts to end the influence of big money in politics and put the power back in the hands of ordinary citizens. So what do you think of Lawrence Lessig's idea? And how would you take money out of politics? When we do shows about everything from education to prisons to the environment, we always get emails and phone calls saying nothing is going to work until we get money out of politics. Today we're joined by Lawrence Lessig. He's professor and director of the Edmund J. Safra Center for Ethics at Harvard University and founder of the Center for Internet and Society. He's author of Republic Lost, How Money Corrupts Congress and a Plan to Stop It, and more recently, The USA of Lesterland, The Corruption of Congress and How to End It. And you can listen to the free podcast online. Lawrence founded the New Hampshire Rebellion. It's a cross-partisan movement to end the root problem of corruption by making political reform the number one issue during the 2016 New Hampshire primary. And Lawrence Lessig joins us from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Lawrence. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Great to be here.
It's great to have you. So when you launched this super PAC, you got a lot of media attention, but almost everybody said this was a crazy idea. And it only took 13 days to raise more than $1 million. So not so crazy.
Yeah, even I was skeptical. And when we launched, there was such extraordinary attention that it melted our servers within 2 days. So it was 13 days to complete, but I think we could have completed in a week if we hadn't hit that bump. And this is a measure of something that I don't think many people recognize, that there is an extraordinary passion out there among citizens to find a way to get their democracy back. And we're trying to offer one way to think about getting that done.
Well, and that's so interesting because the LA Times covered your effort. And in the lead, reporter Maeve Rustin writes, "Is it possible to get voters excited about a subject as dry as campaign finance?" And this was the tone in most of the articles. But as you said, so many people have flocked to the super PAC. And then I was watching videos from the New Hampshire Rebellion. I mean, people, you included, people were walking across the state to get people to talk about this. And it wasn't that difficult to get almost everyone they passed to talk about campaign finance reform.
Yeah, because as you mentioned in your introduction to this, everybody is beginning to recognize that regardless of the issue, whatever you care about, until we address the way in which money corrupts the political process, we're never going to get any sane result, either on the left or the right. You know, if you want smaller government or simpler taxes, you will never get either of those two things until we change the way we fund elections. If you want climate change legislation or better food safety laws or addressing the healthcare crisis, none of those will be solved in a sensible way until we address the way money is raised in campaigns. So as people recognize this, they begin to understand what's necessary. And indeed, in a poll we did at the end of last year, we found 96% of Americans believe it important to reduce the influence of money in politics. What stops them, the reason you don't see them leaping in the streets every moment about this issue, is just about the same percentage of Americans believe it's impossible to reduce the influence of money in politics. So we resign ourselves to a system we believe is unjust. But what we're doing is trying to find ways to give people, as Harvey Milk used to say out there in San Francisco, give people hope, give them a sense that there is, in fact, a way we could fix this. And once we pierce that resignation, what we've found is extraordinary passion and energy to do something about this.
So talk about how this is going to work, because you managed to raise over $1 million in 13 days, and that money is going to be matched. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so the background to this idea was a couple years ago, we started talking about what would it take to win a Congress committed to fundamental reform in 2016. And 2016 is important because, in my view, the window of opportunity to change or fix this system is closing quickly. In 2016, you're going to have a massive super PAC campaigns. And eventually, both parties are just going to settle into this way of raising money to fund their election. So we have to address it and win it in 2016. And when we asked that question, we actually commissioned a political firm to analyze it. They came up with a number, a huge number. But what they said was it was really important to take this issue up in 2014 and to wage a campaign in 2014 that was successful in a small number of seats. They suggested 5 seats, both to teach us what works, what messaging works, how can we rally people to this issue, but also begin to teach Congress about the fact this issue is important. So they estimated the cost of that would be $12 million. And then somebody said to me, well, why don't you kickstart at least half of it? And I was skeptical at first, but I said I would be willing to try it. So we launched a $1 million kickstart on May 1st. As you said, 13 days later, we crossed the $1 million mark. I have until the end of the month to get it matched. We're just about ready to announce the match. And then on June 4th, we will launch the second, much, much more difficult challenge of raising $5 million in a month, so that by Independence Day, we cross the line at $5 million and we'll get that matched as well. And if we do that, then we will be at a point to be able to run this pilot campaign in 2014 that will set us up for the much bigger campaign in 2016.
And who are you working with on this project?
Boy, I feel like I'm working with everybody. You know, we had more than 13... just about 13,000, about 12,700 people who contributed to the original $1 million pledge. I feel like about 8,000 of them have sent emails and ideas and suggestions for what we should be doing to push this to the next level. So originally, you know, it was a couple of us who had been thinking about this and conspiring really among ourselves. How do we get this movement going that, you know, launched it? And, you know, I stood up at the TED Talks this year, and I announced we were going to do this. I announced I was inspired to do this by my friend Aaron Swartz, who 7 years ago convinced me to take this issue up. I said that by his 30th birthday, which would have been on Election Day 2016, we are going to win this issue. And when I made that announcement, from that moment on, we've had an extraordinary number of people come up and offer help, offer technical support, offer advice, offer to help spread the message. And quickly, this is becoming a huge citizen-driven effort to find a way to reclaim our democracy.
How will you decide which politicians to target? Bill Maher has this very popular campaign running right now called Flip a District, where people send in videos about the politician that they want to be ousted. And it's been really fun to watch because so many average people are getting involved in this. How are you going to decide which 5 House districts to target?
Yeah, I mean, Bill Maher's idea is really brilliant. Ours is actually a harder calculation because we've got to do 2 things at once. We've got to pick districts that are in some sense representative of the problem. And by the problem, I mean the challenge we're going to have to convince people to rally to this issue and to actually vote on the basis of this issue, or at least enough people vote on the basis of this issue to decide the election. So that means we can't just take any seat out there. We've got to take seats where the actual makeup of the voters makes it plausible to say that this is a good representative of many, many other seats across the country. And then we've got to pick seats, you know, where we have a real shot of winning, because one really important thing is that we convince people we can win on this issue. And it can't be too easy, but it can't be too hard. And third, we've got to pick seats that when we study the before and after interventions, we can produce the kind of data that will convince skeptical potential supporters in 2016 that there's a real shot that we can win. And finally, we've got to pick seats that when we win, will really send a shockwave through the traditional establishment in Washington, who believes nobody cares about this issue and certainly nobody's going to lose on the basis of it. So we've done an initial calculation of those seats. And when we're absolutely convinced we're going to make the 12 million, then we'll rerun the numbers and see what they will be. And when we make the match of the 5 million, we'll make the announcement of what those seats are going to be.
So the other interesting aspect of this is, what will you do with this money? How will you spend it? Because we do so many shows about the next presidential election is expected to surpass the $7 billion record set in 2012. I mean, it's hard to even wrap your arms around that. But we do shows about how this money is spent, and most of it is spent on media, which then affects how the media covers these issues, right? So how are you planning to spend that $12 million?
We're going to spend it in the way that we are convinced will work to win the elections we're in. You know, we could have a long philosophical debate about where and how money should be spent. But my view is it should be data-driven decision about what we know works and what we know will win. Now, that doesn't mean it's necessarily the traditional way of running campaigns. It doesn't mean necessarily buying tons of television time. We're completely open and we're investigating lots of interesting ways to use new technology. And we will be investigating that all the way up to the point that we make the commitments to the campaign managers who will be running these campaigns. But our objective is to win. And it's to win in a way that demonstrates both to us and to the public why in 2016 we can win in a much bigger way.
You also work with the group, the New Hampshire Rebellion, and you and about 200 people walked nearly the length of New Hampshire. When did that take place? Was that earlier this year or last year?
It was in January. You know, New Hampshire has its primary in January, and so we did the first of three January marches. We started in Dixville Notch, which is where the primary will start. We walked 190 miles down to Nashua, we had more than 200 people participating. There were about 25 who did every single mile. I was happy to be one of those 25, very proud that I had no blisters across that very, very cold walk. But what was astonishing about that experience, and that really was the experience that convinced me just how passionate people are about this issue, was regardless of the people, regardless of their politics. You know, we start in the North, which is Tea Party country. We ended in the South, which is more liberal in New Hampshire. Regardless of their politics, people were so passionately frustrated with this reality of the way our democracy doesn't work. And they were desperate for an idea for how to do something about it. And so just below the surface, I think there's the energy we need to tap into to make this a winnable fight.
And their goal is pretty great. I mean, they're planning to try to get the moderator of the debates in New Hampshire to focus on this issue. They're going to embark on another long walk on July 5th, followed by larger walks in 2015 and 2016. And so by the time the 2016 presidential candidates arrive in New Hampshire, the goal is to have a bunch of voters flock to them and say, okay, this is the one issue that you all need to address.
Right. The idea of the title, the New Hampshire Rebellion, isn't so much that we're rebelling against government. It's that we're rebelling against the politicians. Because what we learned in 2012 is that though this issue of the corruption of the system of corruption in Washington is right at the top of issues Americans care about. In July of 2012, Gallup found it was number two on the list of top 10 issues that Americans thought the next president should address. Neither Romney nor Obama mentioned the issue at all on their website. It was completely invisible. So the idea of the New Hampshire Rebellion is to rebel against the agenda they set for the election by saying, okay, fine, we'll listen to you tell us about how you're going to make unemployment go away and how you're going to make growth in America return and all these great ideas you have for solving every single problem that you're going to talk about. But before you talk about those issues, talk about this issue first. How are you going to end the system of corruption in Washington? Because universally, Democrats, Republicans, and independents alike, people focus on this corruption as the source of the problem that makes it impossible for our government to do anything sensible.
Lawrence Lessig is professor at Harvard University and founder of the Center for Internet and Society. He's the author of several books, including The USA of Lesterland, The Corruption of Congress and How to End It. And you can listen to the free podcast online. He founded the New Hampshire Rebellion, which is a cross-partisan movement to end the root problem of corruption by making political reform the number one issue during the 2016 New Hampshire primary. He recently started the May Day Super PAC to end all super PACs. They managed to raise over $1 million in just 13 days. The average person gave $75. And the goal for this cycle is to raise enough money to change the results in five House districts across the country. So what are your thoughts on Lawrence's plan for this May Day Super PAC? I know that so many of you are really passionate about taking money out of politics. What do you think of this idea? And how would you go about it? How do you think the $12 million should be spent? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255.
You're listening to a rebroadcast episode of Your Call. We can't accept calls at this time.
You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. Judy in San Francisco couldn't stay on, Lawrence, but she wanted to know if there's a way to contribute without using a computer.
Sure. If you go to the, well, okay. I got to give you an address, or maybe you can find the, maybe you can use a computer to find the address, but you can just send a check, and you send a check to May Day PAC, and the post office box is on our site. I'm, you know, obviously stalling as I find the address.
Well, we can find it, I was going to say we'll post it, but we'll actually tell Judy and others who maybe don't use computers whenever you find it.
I can tell it right here.
Okay, perfect.
Post office box 380-444, Cambridge, Massachusetts, 02238.
Okay, P.O. Box 380-444, Cambridge, Massachusetts, 02238.
Right.
And I'll repeat that later. Thank you for calling in, Judy. Let's hear from David in San Francisco. Hi, David. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose and Lawrence. I had a specific view on it that I think most people, right and left, agree that there's such enormous corruption and lying at the top that even the Tea Party people realize that they got snookered by the Republicans. So some of your arguments are going to be easy to patch, but I think that the stats, the data that'll finally convince them are going to be based upon the economics. And so if every state and county were to basically buy an economist, put one on staff, one that would tell them whether or not they should close down their library or close down their school system, whether it's cost-effective to have 911 or poison control centers, whether or not the neocon lies that say that they just have to shut down the hospitals, they just have to shut down the schools, are so preposterous that they almost don't need a rebuttal, but that there do definitely need to be economists that can damn well prove to the city councilmen and the various boards, the sewer boards, for example, that are being deluged with pollution, and yet they're being put on a budget cut. Various aspects of what we take as normal in our society, fresh, clean water out of the tap, we're going through systems now where private companies are buying up the county-owned fresh water systems. And it's being done with such a preposterous series of lies that market forces can make sure that our fresh water coming out of the tap is run by some private corporation.
David, thanks for calling in. There's a documentary that addresses this called We're Not Broke. But Lawrence, what are your thoughts about each city having its own economist to address these issues?
Well, I think there's a great point that we need to have a reason to trust the government when the government says to us, this is what should be done about any number of issues, clean water, clean air, should there be tons of antibiotics poured into the feed that cattle and chickens and salmon eat before they're fed to us? These are hard questions that, you know, most of us don't have time to investigate in a serious way. So when the government makes a decision, we have to have a good reason to trust them. And I think what most people begin to recognize now is that there is no good reason to trust them, that the infection of special interest money inside of our political system makes it almost impossible for us to have confidence that when the government, the Department of Agriculture, allows these antibiotics spread into our environment, it's not because scientists have said this is actually safe or not raising important problems in the way it affects humans. It's because it's politically too costly to question the way in which the system is being done right now. So we have to change that. We have to make it so people have a reason to trust. And the way to do that, I think, is to change the way we fund elections. Because if we change the way we fund elections, you give politicians more opportunity to reflect on what they think the right answer should be, as opposed to what they think the answer should be to get them the most campaign dollars. And it's not just at Congress, I agree, it's at every level of government, but the part I'm focused on right now is at the level of Congress.
Do you know how many candidates for Congress have finance reform as part of their platform?
I don't know about their platform. I mean, you know, the most important proposal for reform that's actually got the largest support is John Sarbanes' bill, which is the Government by the People Act. And Sarbanes' bill has 154 co-sponsors in the House right now. We need 218 to pass. So it's the biggest, it's the one with the biggest chance to pass, and I think it would be an important radical change in the way campaigns were funded. But I think the biggest thing we're trying to do through the Mayday PAC is to give more candidates a reason to get out in front about this issue, to say this is the issue that matters to them. As more candidates do that, I think you'll see more people rallying to force them to take the right side on this issue.
All right. Well, thanks for calling in, David. Let's go next to Mike in Oakland. Hi, Mike. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thanks for taking on this important topic. Professor, you have obviously you've seen millions of your fellow Americans behind you in this effort. But I wanted to ask you about the next step. Assuming that you're successful, and given the remarkable activism of today's Supreme Court conservative majority, what are the features of legislation that you would like to see implemented that you think would be immune to the slash and burn creativity of Scalia and Thomas and others?
Great question. Really great question. So the first thing is to be clear about what the problem is. You know, we in America have outsourced the funding of political campaigns to the tiniest fraction of the 1%. In the book that was referenced, The United States is Lesterland, the title comes from the fact that the relevant funders of congressional campaigns in the United States are about 150,000 Americans, which is about the same number of people who are named Lester in the United States. So this tiny, tiny fraction are the funders. And then the rest of us are the electors. And that outsourcing is, in my view, the core problem to the way in which our politics has been corrupted, because it takes such a small number of them to band together to basically veto any reform that either side of the political spectrum wants to advance. Sometimes I'm puzzled that people don't see this as a problem, as an obvious problem. If it's not obvious to you that this is a problem, imagine instead of outsourcing to the Lesters in the United States the funding of campaigns, we outsourced it to the Chinese. The Chinese said, we'll fund your campaigns. I mean, we won't get everybody the same amount of money. They'll have to come to us and convince us how much they should get.
And Lawrence,
we'll give them...
Hold that thought. We're going to take a quick break. We're speaking with Lawrence Lessig, professor at Harvard, about taking money out of politics. It's your call. We'll be back.
This is a rebroadcast episode of Your Call, so we can't take your calls or emails. Lawrence Lessig's May Day Super PAC campaign to get big money out of politics is past the $2 million mark and working towards a goal of $5 million by July 4th. That's tomorrow. You can find out more information about the May Day Super PAC, including ways to support it, on our website, yourcallradio.org. We'll be right back.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about the best way to get money out of politics. What do you think are the best ways? And what do you think of Lawrence Lessig's plan? He created a May Day super PAC to basically end all super PACs. They've already raised $1 million in just 13 days. The average person gave $75. And the goal for this election cycle is to raise enough money to change the results in five House districts across the country, and then for 2016, put the rest of Congress on notice. Lawrence Lessig is professor at Harvard University and author of Republic Lost, How Money Corrupts Congress and a Plan to Stop It, and more recently, The USA of Lesterland, The Corruption of Congress and How to End It. He also founded the New Hampshire Rebellion. It's a cross-partisan movement to end the root problem of corruption by making political reform the number one issue during the 2016 New Hampshire primary. And you can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. So, Lawrence, you were addressing Mike's question. What are your thoughts about, you know, how would you deal with money in politics at a time when we have Citizens United and the recent decision that struck down aggregate contribution limits? And all the journalists that we have on the show say, you know, we're having a hard time tracking dark money, and it's just going to get worse because people don't have to reveal the amounts they give.
Yeah, that is a problem. And that dark money problem could be solved by a statute in Congress tomorrow. But even if you solve the dark money problem, you wouldn't solve the problem that I was talking about, the problem of outsourcing the funding of campaigns to such a tiny fraction of Americans. The solution to that problem is to change the way we fund elections. There are Republican proposals for doing that. There are Democrat proposals for doing that. Republican proposals say basically give all voters vouchers that they can use to fund small-dollar candidates who agree to fund their campaigns with vouchers only. That would radically change the way congressmen raise their money. They would be focused not on the Lesters, the tiniest fraction of the 1%. They'd be focused on everybody. Democrats have a slightly different version of the same idea. John Sarbanes' bill, again, proposes the idea of matching funds. So if you contribute $100 to a campaign, it can be matched 9-to-1, so it's worth $1,000 to that campaign. That, too, would radically change the way we fund elections. Now, both of those ideas, vouchers and matching funds, are completely safe from Supreme Court invalidation. Even this court has signaled again and again that Congress is free to change the way elections are funded. What the court has attacked are laws which attempt to restrict the ability of people to spend their money to participate in the political system. So this change is not the target of what Citizens United was about, and it wasn't the target of what the aggregate campaign case was about, McCutcheon, which again was about trying to limit people's participation, not about enabling a wider range of people to participate in the funding of elections.
We have a comment on our website from a listener who says, in the United Kingdom, I believe they still have free airtime on the BBC for candidates during their six-week election period. Don't the broadcasting networks owe this to the American people? Isn't that where most of the money in campaigns go? Why can't we have such a system here? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think morally, they certainly owe it to the American people. But constitutionally, it's not clear Congress could actually mandate that they give it. And even if Congress could mandate that the broadcasters give it, it's pretty clear Congress couldn't mandate that cable companies do it, because cable companies don't take advantage of the airways. Cable companies take advantage of infrastructure that, with certain privileges given to them by the government, they have built. So the point is, under our First Amendment, we have a very narrow range of options that the court has left for us for addressing this problem about how campaigns are run. And the second part of the question, which is also very important, you know, the elections in Britain are short because there's no predictable schedule for the elections. It's basically when the government calls for an election. But in the United States, we know when the election is. So campaigns begin far in advance of the election. And in the way that we run campaigns right now, basically there's a permanent campaign in America. Every single day between one election and the next is a campaign day where they're trying to raise money for the next election. We don't have any time when people are actually allowed to govern anymore. It's just this perpetual fight between the Democrats and Republicans to regain control the next time around.
We have an email from Denise who says, how about third-party candidates? These candidates are always talking about money in politics. However, they don't get airtime. Will they be included in your efforts to eliminate money in politics?
So we absolutely want to encourage third parties in this process. In 2014, though, we have to demonstrate the viability of this idea. And so when we look at candidates, we have a very strict test, which is the target of our spending in this campaign somebody who's been clearly on the wrong side of this issue, and is the effective beneficiary of our intervention somebody who is on the right side of this issue and has a significant chance to win? And because of the embedded two-party system in the United States, unfortunately, there are very few places in the United States where an independent or a third-party candidate has a choice to win. But we're looking at it. It would be wonderful if we could support such a candidate.
All right. Thank you for the email, Denise. Let's go next to John in San Francisco. Hi, John.
Yes. Good morning, Rose, and thank you for taking my call. I'd like to ask your guest, what is his opinion of the efforts of Public Citizen, which is currently working nationwide to get the resources together and the support together to establish a constitutional amendment which would reverse Citizens United. This is something that they're working on. Of course, it's a long-term process, much longer than the one the professor has referred to, but I'd like to know what is his opinion of it.
It's a great question. Public Citizen, Move to Amend, Free Speech for People. There have been a wide range of groups who have done enormously important work to get people to rally around the idea of a constitutional amendment to address the problem of money in politics. The challenge, though, is that to get an amendment out of Congress requires two-thirds of both houses to vote in favor of that amendment. So in the Senate, it requires 67 senators to vote for such an amendment. And the problem is, right now, you couldn't get one United States senator from the Republican Party, at least, to vote in favor of such an amendment. So until we've radically changed Congress, there's no chance that we're going to get this out of the United States Congress. Now, other people, and I've been part of this movement, too, have been trying to pursue the second path that the framers of our Constitution gave us for getting proposed amendments before the states for consideration. You know, when the framers drafted the Constitution, 2 days before they were going to publish it, somebody noticed that the only way to propose an amendment was if Congress proposed it. And George Mason from Virginia stood up and said, well, what if Congress is the problem? What if corruption has taken over Congress? We can never fix the problem. So they created a second path. And the second path was the states have the power to demand that Congress create a convention that has the power to propose amendments to the Constitution. It can't change the Constitution. It can't change the way amendments are ratified. It can only propose amendments. And indeed, right now in California, there's an incredible group called 99 Rise, which is marching from Los Angeles to Sacramento, 450 miles. And I'm going to join them next on the 3rd, which is my birthday. I'm going to join them for a day to walk with them. And they're marching to Sacramento to try to get Sacramento, the politicians in Sacramento, to adopt a resolution calling on Congress to convene a convention for the purpose of proposing exactly the kind of amendments that Public Citizen is talking about. And I think that's actually, in the short term, a more viable strategy, because I don't think we're going to get 67 senators in the United States Senate anytime soon.
And they're marching on June 3rd? Is that when it is?
They've already started marching. They're going to... I'm going to march with them on June 3rd.
Okay.
They're coming up the Central Valley, and they'll be in Sacramento by the 4th of July.
You know, I mean, these efforts are so amazing, Lawrence. And you'd think, you know, we host this radio show in the Bay Area, and I haven't even heard of this march. I mean, the march in New Hampshire, I mean, did that get much media attention? It seems like there's just so much activity around this issue, but it just doesn't get much media attention.
Well, we were fortunate in New Hampshire. It's a small state. And by the second day, the one television station in New Hampshire was basically tracking our progress, kind of like, you know, the Santa tracker. We were the New Hampshire Rebellion tracker as we moved down through the states. Everybody knew about us. They honked their horns and greeted us, came out in their pajamas to welcome us. So in New Hampshire, we had a lot of attention. But California's a big state.
Yeah.
And so it's hard to focus attention. But, you know, if you look at 99 Rise on the web, 99rise.org, you'll see their progress and their work. And it's an incredibly important movement in California. And I hope it's ultimately successful.
480 miles marching from L.A. to Sacramento. You can find more information. We'll put a link at yourcallradio.org right after the show. We're speaking today with Lawrence Lessig, professor at Harvard University and author of The USA of Lesterland, The Corruption of Congress and How to End It. He's been working to get money out of politics for 7 years. His latest project is the May Day Super PAC. The goal is to end all super PACs. They've raised $1 million in just 13 days. The average contribution, $75. And you can find more information at yourcallradio.org. And you can join us at 866.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of Your Call. We can't accept calls at this time.
Well, what are your thoughts on the best ways to get money out of politics? You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. Let's hear next from John in Santa Barbara. Hi, John. Welcome to the show.
Hi there. John D. Herrera, longtime advocate for convention, what the professor was just mentioning there. I just the idea that I like is that we have state and federal highway systems, and in order to use those highway systems, a citizen has to meet certain criteria. And so if we ever did get this amendment proposed to the states, the amendment would just create a system that if someone wants to become a public servant and they meet certain criteria, you know, maybe signature, something along those lines, but if they meet that criteria, they're automatically plugged in to the system and they get the same amount of exposure, etc. So something like that would just remove private money from public government. And I think if we did that, then in a natural progression of events, everything else would be taken care of. And just real briefly, what was the name of the group again that's marching?
In California?
Yeah.
That one, you can go to marchfordemocracy.org. It's called California March for Democracy.
Oh, no. What was it, 99 Live?
99 Rise.
So 99 Rise sponsored it, but I think you're right. That's the name of the webpage. But either if you go to the 99 Rise webpage, 99rise.org, you'll be linked to the March page. But as to the first point, you know, I think we need a convention in large part to figure out what the right answer is. There are a lot of great proposals out there. And what we know is that while the vast majority of us, more than 90% of us, believe the problem of money in politics has to be addressed, when you turn to the solution, there's a wide range of very different answers. And that's what we need the chance to deliberate on. And we need the chance to deliberate on it because we can't trust that deliberation to the politicians. People inside of Washington, you know, have their existing system. One of the worst parts of that system is that for many of them, it's a way for them to become extraordinarily wealthy. They become Capitol Hill, as Jim Cooper, Democrat from Tennessee, put it, has become a kind of farm league for K Street with lobbyist work, because they all have in their mind their graduation from Capitol Hill to becoming a lobbyist. And the lobbying system depends on this existing system surviving. So we need people outside of Washington to sit down and do what the framers thought we would do, which is when Washington is corrupted, we have the chance to figure out how to fix it and have the constitutional opportunity to put before the states a way to fix it.
We have an email from Carlton again about third parties, and he said, I had to turn off the radio because I can't stand to hear the same old status quo about how anyone other than Republicans and Democrats are just too radical to consider. And just be patient, everybody, and maybe when your grandkids are adults, there will be some alternative to rule by millionaires. What are your thoughts about that, Lawrence, about people who say that this system is just not working and the only solution is to work outside of it or to focus on third parties?
Well, first, you know, I didn't say anything about third parties being too radical. To the contrary, I don't think third parties are radical. They are just disadvantaged, severely disadvantaged, by the two-party duopoly that has been developed inside of our republic. Now, I don't favor that duopoly. I think that has to be attacked and reformed, and I would be the first person to support that reform. But the question is, what is the sequence of reform we should be exercised on here, right? So should we worry about money and politics first, or should we worry about ending the two-party system? And the thing about the two-party system is that both parties love it. So if you want to take on the two-party system, you're not taking on, you know, the Democrats, or you're not taking on the Republicans, you're taking on both of them. And in order to do that, I think you need to create an independent source of power to be able to do that. And the independent source that you could create would be a different way of funding elections. So that's why I think addressing the way we fund elections first is the first step towards a whole slew of reforms that I think many people believe we have to undertake. But this is the one we have to undertake first.
All right. Thank you, Carlton. Jeff couldn't stay on the line, but he wants to know your thoughts on dealing with the amount of money people like the Koch brothers have and give to politicians.
It's a great question because, you know, we tend to forget first that people like the Koch brothers or the Soros Soros or any other rich person, T-Bone Pickens, have been free to spend their money to advocate or oppose a political candidate. Unlimited amounts of money since 1976. And until super PACs were created, they were pretty shy about spending their money. They basically didn't. You know, in 1992, the total amount spent was something like $900,000. But it was the creation of super PACs, which are political action committees that are independent of a campaign, but which can take unlimited contributions. When they created super PACs, then these rich people found their voice because they could basically hide their identity inside the super PAC. So it was no longer T. Boone Pickens who would stand up and take the flack from pushing one candidate or another. It was Americans for a Better Way tomorrow, yesterday, or whatever. You know, the point is these entities became the laundering mechanisms for people wanting to spend large amounts of money. And that's the thing we have to change. Now, you know, it would take a very important constitutional change to make it so that, you know, the Kochs can't themselves spend their own money independent of a political action committee. But I actually think it's not that hard to imagine the court permitting Congress to limit the amount of money that independent political action committees can take. The Supreme Court has never addressed that question. It was a lower court that struck those limits down and created the super PACs. And in my own view, that's still an open question. But the really important objective is to make it so the few can't dominate the election process by contributing to these entities that basically become indirect ways of running political campaigns.
Thank you for the question, Jeff. Let's go next to Steve in Mountain View. Hi, Steve. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. My name is Steve Chesson. I'm president of Californians for Electoral Reform. The discussion about third parties is a good segue into my question. The professor is from Harvard, which is in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Cambridge uses proportional representation to elect their city council, as does most of Western Europe. Proportional representation makes gerrymandering ineffective and does enable third parties to get elected. And it doesn't require a constitutional amendment to use it for Congress, just changing a federal law. And states can also adopt proportional representation for their own legislatures on their own. So I'd like to hear the professor's thoughts on proportional representation, if that would be the second reform he would take on after handling the money issue.
So I'm a supporter of the idea of changing the winner-take-all system. There are different ways to do it. San Francisco is a little bit different from how Cambridge does it. And I think we should certainly take steps towards implementing these alternatives and seeing which one seems to capture best the will of the people in a more responsive way. But if we do that before we fix the way we fund elections, we will only increase the cost of elections, without addressing the problem of the enormous influence that this tiny fraction of the 1% have inside of our political system. So, again, I want to stay as disciplined as I can on issue number one and invite lots of issues to be recognized as the important second issue that we have to address, and this would certainly be top on my list.
This became a major issue for you about 7 years ago. You talk about this in your TED Talk and in interviews, and you can watch Lawrence's TED Talk. We have a link at yourcallradio.org. When you had a conversation with Aaron Swartz, the young internet freedom activist, who took his own life last January. We've done shows about Aaron. Can you tell us a little bit about that conversation and just the issues that Aaron raised that made you really think about campaign finance reform?
Yeah, so, Aaron and I had been collaborators for many years around open internet issues and open access to culture and knowledge issues. And he was one of the original architects of the Creative Commons technical infrastructure. So this was our common project. And he came to visit me in Berlin, where I was spending the year writing a book, which was my last book about copyright. It's called Remix. And I was actually preparing for my first TED Talk. And I was very proud to show him what I was doing and excited about the work that I was completing. And he was a little bit unimpressed, and that kind of hurt me a little bit. And he said to me, how do you think you're ever going to make any progress on these issues so long as there's this basic corruption in the way our political system works? And I said to him, Aaron, that's not my field. I do internet policy, copyright. I'm not a political scientist. And he said, yeah, I get that. It's not your field as an academic, but as a citizen, is it your field as a citizen? And, this was just Aaron's way. He didn't really lecture. He asked questions. And that question was a punch in the gut for me because I realized that he was right. Obviously, he was right. And I had an extraordinary opportunity. I had tenure at a great university, which means that I had the freedom to pursue what I wanted to pursue. I had no excuse like, it's not my job. It could be my job. I can make it my job. Nobody can fire me because I changed my ideas about what I want to work on. So I said to him, decided I would change my project. He and I started working together. We started a group back then called Change Congress, which was a kind of precursor to a lot of this work. I honestly believed that there would be a day that the two of us working on this project would see it come to fruition. And we won't see it together come to fruition, but for him, I would not be where I am here, and I want to succeed in large part because of the inspiration he was to me and so many others around the world.
And Aaron Swartz, he died shortly before he was set to go to trial for downloading millions of academic articles from servers at MIT because he believed they should be available online for free. He was facing 35 years at the time, and we're actually planning to do a show about the new documentary about Aaron, the Internet's Own Boy, and obviously, this is so hard on you because you were both friends, and I understand that the latest TED Talk you gave sort of pulled you out of the depression that you were dealing with because of Aaron's death.
Yeah, actually, it wasn't perfectly clear in that talk. What I meant was, I gave a TED Talk last year, a month after Aaron died, and it was having to give that talk which really saved me because, nothing in my life comes close to the pain which his death caused. I think all of us who knew him and loved him felt we had failed him. And when he died, I thought I'd lost everything. I mean, obviously I hadn't. I have an amazing family, these small kids who knew him and loved him. But the urgency of standing up and telling the story of why I was doing what I was doing last year saved me. And then when I came back this year, I revealed in that TED Talk the way in which last year's TED Talk was really a way to escape the profound depression that I found myself in after learning of his death.
I mean, you're not only raising awareness about campaign finance, but you're raising awareness about Aaron Swartz's own story and just what he believed in.
Yeah, and we should for the rest of our lives do that, because none of us who knew him, I think, believe we've come across somebody who can so profoundly inspire. And I think that's the inspiration we have to carry forward. That's our job. That's all we can do. Mm. That's all that's left.
And Lawrence, we have about a minute left. I mean, this is now your passion and your, you know, this is what you're working on, campaign finance. What has it been like for you over the last 7 years to really focus on this issue?
The most important transition is from the academic to the engaged. And, you know, the walk in New Hampshire, which began on the anniversary of Aaron's death, is the thing that carried me into the place, again, Harvey Milk talked about. There's hope. Give people hope that there's a way to fix this.
Lawrence
and
Lessig,
we'll fix it.
Lawrence Lessig
and
is
we'll
professor
it.
At Harvard University and founder of the May Day Super PAC. The goal is to end all super PACs. You can find more information about that super PAC at yourcallradio.org. You can also find more information about the New Hampshire Rebellion. Lawrence, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. And thank you for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. Aaron Swartz changed the internet. On the next Your Call, we'll rebroadcast a conversation we had with Brian Knappenberger, director of The Internet's Own Boy. The film is about the programming prodigy and information activist Aaron Swartz. He committed suicide last year as he faced criminal charges for downloading academic files. Online communities were shocked and outraged. The film asks, what do we lose when we're tone deaf about technology and its relationship to our civil liberties? That's on the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.